those most of you will know, just about everyone will know, we've been the theme of this series has been great Buddhist texts. So last week we moved from the great Buddhist texts that were written in Pali, the Pali canon, which are the closest we get to the sort of recorded words of the Buddha life, things in the history of the historical Buddha, to what's called Mahayana Buddhism, which contrasts itself with what it calls Hinayana. Mahayana meaning great vehicle or great way, the followers of which rather disparagingly called everybody else Hinayana, or followers of the lesser way. So this was a movement in Buddhism that emerged maybe around the time of the beginning of the Christian era. We saw that there were some big major theme differences in the Mahayana. It was not only was it a new teaching, but it was re-emphasizing things which seemed to have got a bit lost sight of, perhaps, by some of the Buddha's followers over the course of 500 years, that were definitely there in the original teaching, but or the original spirit, but maybe lost sight of. One of which was altruism, the importance of compassion, the importance of kindness, etc., rather than it being all about wisdom. One was the idea of skillful means. The Buddha, sort of on a number of occasions, said, well, all teachings, really, they're not the absolute truth. You can't say what the absolute truth is. They're skillful means. They're ways of moving towards it or ways of referring to it. And the image of the sort of nature of the Buddha in these texts was different. So the Buddha in the Pali canon is very much an individual human being. He's a human being from a particular time and a place, whereas the Buddha in a lot of the Mahayana scriptures, sutras, is some sort of much more universal, something much more universal, the principle of Buddhahood. Maybe in us, maybe in the universe, whichever way you want to look at it. Maybe it doesn't make much difference, or maybe both. Some sort of not just an enlightened human being, but the enlightened mind, something we can tap into, something that can help us, something that's active, something that we can contact, a bit like Pingya seemed to contact something when he was meditating on the Buddha. So those are three sort of themes that come out of the Mahayana, which we're going to sort of look at really. Well, as we go through it, we'll look at each of those in quite a lot of detail. But there's another sort of phrase or theme, if you like, that gets dealt with in the White Lotus Sutra that I'd like to have a look at today, and that's the idea of Buddha nature. I don't know, you might have come across this. If you've read enough books on Zen, you will have come across this. The idea that somehow it's not somehow that we've got Buddha nature, somehow that our real nature is to be enlightened, and that is trying to get out. So that's a sort of theme that comes out in some Mahayana scriptures, and it's a theme that comes out in the White Lotus Sutra. So we'll sort of return to that. But first of all, I just want to set the context. So I talked a little bit about the White Lotus Sutra last week, but I just want to give you a bit more of a flavour by setting the sort of context. So the White Lotus Sutra opens with the Buddha on Vulture's Peak, as you might find him in a Pali Canon Sutta. But it's a very different Buddha, and it's a very different Vulture's Peak. Vulture's Peak here is another dimension, really. And the Buddha is sitting in meditation on Vulture's Peak, surrounded by all sorts of beings, not just humans, but all sorts of beings. And he's sitting in deep meditation, and he emits a ray of light from between his eyebrows, which illuminates the whole universe. Now, this is a different Buddha from the Buddha of the Pali Canon, right? The Buddha of the Pali Canon never emits a light from between his eyebrows, which illuminates the whole universe. He might be appear to be telepathic, be able to speak to his followers at a distance, be able to talk to devas, all sorts of things like that, but no rays of light that illuminate the whole universe. This is a much more sort of cosmic, almost science fiction sort of Buddha. And so he does this, and people are astounded. Whoa! he's emitted a ray of light which has illuminated the whole universe. What does it mean? And somebody says, I think it's Manjushri, being very wise, says, ah, well, whenever in the past I have seen a Buddha do that, he's always been about to teach the White Lotus Sutra. As though the White Lotus Sutra is sort of like a universal next phase of the teaching. Or he's always been about to tell us the true Dharma, the nature of the true Dharma. So this is a fairly auspicious occasion. And the Buddha then proceeds to do that. And he proceeds to say, I am now about to give you a new teaching. And at this point, a load of people, I think it's 5,000, go, whoa, a new teaching? Impossible. It cannot be a new teaching. And they walk out. No, there couldn't be. We've been given the teaching. The Buddha taught what was teaching. That was the teaching. And there can't be a new one, so I'm off, basically. So it's making a point, in a way. It's making a point that, well, there can be, the teachings are skillful means. We may need to move from one to another. There are different ways of teaching the Dharma, different ways of different teachings which will help human beings to move forward. And the worst thing that we can be, the thing that will absolutely stop us in our spiritual tracks, is thinking we know it all. If we think we know it all, so we can't hear anything new, we're stuck. Yeah. If we think we understand, then we're really stuck. Because the Buddha also says, only Buddhas understand. Only Buddhas can understand the nature of the truth, and Bodhisattvas by the power of faith. So it's sort of contrasting spiritual arrogance with a more faith-based approach, saying actually the only way we get near it is a more faith-based approach. We have to sort of go more with our intuition. So this teaching about skillful means is really brought out then. I'll say something else. So the Buddha gives this teaching. And 5,000 people go, huh, well, I'm off. And the Buddha says, the assembly is now going to be much more sort of, it's got much more about it. We're really going somewhere now. And Shariputra, at this point, is delighted. So Shariputra is always held up as the archetype of wisdom in the Pali Canon. But he's absolutely delighted. He's delighted because there is something more to do. He had got the idea that he'd done it all. And it was a bit like, done it all. But there was somewhere more to go. It's not like there's an end point. There was a new phase. So Shariputra is absolutely delighted. And in order to express his delight, he tells a parable. Well, that's a funny thing to do, to tell you to express your delight. But he does. He tells a parable, which is the parable of the burning house. And Padmavajra is going to talk to us next week about the parable of the burning house. But it's basically talking about skillful means, not wishing to steal his thunder. It's a parable about a burning house and a father who is like the Buddha. And the father, to get his children out of the house, offers them all sorts of different toys. The toys that they can relate to tempt them out of the danger of the burning house. And when they get outside, he gives them something which is far more wonderful than anything any of them can imagine. So it's saying there may be lots of teachings. It may be the case that we need all sorts of toys to get us out of the burning house according to temperament. People are attracted by different things. And none of those teachings is the real goal. The real goal is outside of the house. We won't know what it is till we get there. So having stolen Padmavajra's thunder somewhat, always a good thing to do. I want to move on to something to do with this idea of Buddha nature. So there's a couple of stories in the White Lotus Sutra that relate to Buddha nature. I'm going to talk about one briefly and one at length. So the one I'm going to talk about very, very briefly is a story about the jewel in the robe. So the White Lotus Sutra is packed with these parables, because the Buddha says, well, but through a story, people will understand. So it's packed with these parables or stories. And in this story, there's two men are together. One of them's very rich, and one of them's very poor. They're good friends, best of friends. And they get drunk. Not very Buddhist, but there you go. They get drunk. And while they're drunk, the really rich one says to the really poor one, look, I'm going to give you this jewel of incalculable value. And if you ever in need, you know, here's this jewel. This jewel will make you a rich man. So just so that you don't forget about it, just so you don't lose it, I'm going to sew it into your robe right here and now. So he sews this jewel into his robe. And then they part. But because they were drunk, the poor guy doesn't remember anything about the jewel. And he goes wandering around for years and decades being really poor and in real need and having a really hard time, having to do all sorts of horrible things, live in all sorts of horrible places. And then he meets up after a long time, he meets up with his friend again. He's looking a bit sort of bedraggled and, you know, he's had a really hard time. And his friend says, oh, why, come on, why the long face? You know, what's been going on? And he says, well, you know, my life's really hard. He says, well, what about that jewel I sewed into your robe? And he says, what jewel? He says, look, you've been so poor, you haven't even got a new robe. Let's have a look. And there it is. And he's got the jewel. And all his problems are over because he's discovered his jewel. So this seems to be, so the jewel, of course, is Buddha nature. The jewel is our spiritual potential. And what this seems to be saying is that we've got this spiritual potential, this Buddha nature, but we don't know it. And as long as we don't know it, we're going to live as poor, needy people. But if we just discovered it, we'd be fine. So that parable seems to be saying that what we need to do is just to discover our Buddha nature. And that would be okay, that would end our spiritual poverty. To discover our Buddha nature. But there's another story, which is the story, we usually call it the story of the return journey, or the story of the father and the son, which has a bit of a different take on Buddha nature. So I'd like you to think as we go through, what's the difference? How is this a different take on Buddha nature to the jewel in the robe? The jewel in the robe says, you know, it's there all the time, find it and you're fine. Find it and your need is over. So what does this one say differently? So this is the story of the rich father and his son, or the story of the return journey. Before I tell the story, though, I'd like to just ask you, to say something about how we approach this story. So how we judge this story. This story is aimed at a particular time and place. And if we judge it with, what should we say, a sort of 21st century liberal sensibility, we might get in trouble. Okay? So if we think, so some of the premises of this story are that being rich is good and being poor is bad. Okay? Being rich is good and being poor is bad. Being poor by choice as a renunciate is fine. Yeah? But being poor not by choice is not good. Okay? According to this story. So if we can just accept that. Being rich is good, high, noble. Being poor is low. Dirty, you probably are dirty, etc. So that's the sort of cultural milieu, unless you're a monk or a nun, in which case it's fine because you've chosen poverty. So that's the sort of cultural milieu. So should we try and listen to the story with the ears of the people it was aimed at, where that was true, rather than thinking, well, what's wrong with being poor? And why is being rich good? Because it won't work if we do it that way. But so that's a particularly sort of 21st century thing. So maybe we can just sort of put that aside for the time being. And this is a story of a very, very rich father and his son. But when the son is very young, he gets separated from his father. He loses his father. He gets lost. And he can't find his way back. So he's... he's a familyless nobody, basically, living in ancient India, with no skills, no family, no support structure, no background, nothing. So he would have been one of the absolute underclass. He would have sunk to the lowest position in society, which if you've ever been to India, you would know what that would be like. It's not like you can't afford a very expensive mobile phone. It's like you live in hovels. You can't wash. You have to wear the same clothes all the time. You only do the most menial jobs. You clean the drains, or you shovel the stuff out of outhouses. You do the things that nobody else will do, and you're looked down on. So he lives this terrible life. He lives this really poor life, the life of an outcast, the life of a underclass, living in hovels, eating the very, very poorest food, doing the terriblest jobs, so that he's often unhealthy, wearing rags, being filthy. And he lived like this among the sort of other members of the underclass, who often have rather devious habits. And he lived like this for months, for years, for decades. He lived like this for ages. He lived like this for decades. Until, as it says in the sutra, it became second nature to him. So he thought of himself as a low being. He came to think of himself as a low being. And meanwhile, his father is incredibly rich. Incredibly rich. And very, very respected. He lives in a palace. He lives in a palace full of treasures and fine art, surrounded by a beautiful garden, beautiful landscape garden full of peacocks. I'm making this up, but it's beautiful. It's all beautiful. He's surrounded by beautiful people, beautifully dressed, all behaving very well. He's got musicians. He holds court. He holds a sort of courtly sort of social life. When he goes out on, he doesn't just go down the shops. He goes out with elephants and banners and trumpets. And he's a big, you know, he's a big figure. He's a big figure. And he's surrounded by rich, beautiful people all the time. And one day, after decades of the son being separated and living this very, very low life, he happens in his travels to walk past the gates of his father's palace, and he sees his father sitting there, sort of in state, surrounded by beautiful, well-dressed people. And he thinks, oh, it's a king or something like that. And he's terrified. He thinks, I'm in the wrong place. I mean, completely the wrong place. Imagine, I mean, I don't know what it might be like. You've been digging the garden, and you suddenly find yourself at a garden party in Buckingham Palace. And you sort of think, oh, I'm out of here. You know, I mean, I just don't feel right here at all. So that's how he feels. So he wants to get out of there. He's scared. He wants to get out of there. But his father sees him. And his father says to two of his servants, it's my son, catch that man. And he sees these guys running towards him. He thinks, oh, I must have done something wrong. So he legs it. And these guys leg it after him. These guys, seeing him run, assume he must have done something wrong. So they leg it after him, rugby tackle him, bring him to the ground. And he's terrified. He's terrified. And he's fighting like Billy-O to get away. So the father sees this isn't quite working as he intended. It's not quite working as he intended. So he calls him off. Leave him, leave him, leave him, leave him, leave him. So he sees that this isn't going to work, so he lets him go. It says in the sutra, it sees that his son's disposition is inferior, and that his own lordly position causes him distress and fear. So he sees that his son's disposition is inferior, that his own lordly position causes him distress. So his son's disposition is inferior, and that his own lordly position causes him distress and fear. So what he sees is that there's no way he can just say, hey, it's my son, you know, son, come in, come in, come in, sit down, have some caviar, whatever they eat. They wouldn't have eaten caviar in India. They were vegetarians. Okay, so he sees that that's just not going to work. That's just not going to work. Anyway, so he lets the son go, but he finds out where he lives. He finds out where he lives, and he sends two men to go and offer him a job. But he thinks, well, I better send some suitable men. So he sends two men who it describes as, in the sutra, one-eyed, squat, of common and uninspiring appearance. Common and uninspiring, of doleful and undignified appearance. So, he sends the two sort of least prepossessing of his employees to go and search out his son in his hovel and offer him something, offer him a job, basically, offer him a job. So they offer him a job shifting piles of dirt from outhouses, and they offer him double wages for it. So it's quite significant that he's offered what he's used to. He's offered something that's close to what he's used to, and he's offered a reward that he can relate to, double wages. I don't think if it said, come and sit as a prince in state, and you can have, but he gives him something that he can relate to. Shoveling dirt from outhouses for double wages. So the son's delighted with this, double wages, he can buy almost enough dal and rice to feed himself. He works away cleaning outhouses, he works away at cleaning outhouses, moving piles of crap around, doing all the filthiest jobs around the place, and he does this for a long, long, long time. And his father observes him from the window, sees him from the window of his palace, and it says that he sees that his son is foolish and inferior, and feels deeply sorry for him. The father actually longs to end his son's present condition. He longs to have his son back. Longs to end his son's present condition. But he knows he can't do that by force. That his son needs to grow. And he needs a strategy for that. So he's got to have a strategy to help his son grow up, grow to the point where he can be his heir. So he develops a strategy for gradually making his son less foolish and inferior, as he sees. Raising his self-image, raising his level of being, making him fit in this context to be almost a king's son. So as his first step, he thinks, well, I better get to know him. So he sort of reduces himself to a level that his son can relate to. Not quite to his son's level, but a level that his son can relate to. He pretends to be a foreman. But he sort of smears himself with dirt. He sort of dirts himself up and he sort of dresses down. And he pretends to be a foreman. And he and he starts out, so he works with him. And he starts out being quite fierce, actually, as a foreman. He says, shift that pile of dirt, you lazy so-and-so, get on with it, you're not working hard enough. He starts out being quite fierce. In a way, he's behaving as the son sort of expects him to behave, as a foreman. But as time goes on, the foreman, he pretends to take a liking to his son. He obviously already loves him, but he pretends that I've taken a liking to you. I like the cut of your jib, young man. You stick around and work here. I'll see you right. I'll look after you. I'll see you right. So they develop a relationship. He's sort of reduced himself to a level that his son can relate to, and they form a relationship. And after a while, having pretended to be the foreman, he reveals that he's not the foreman at all. He's the owner of the palace. And he says, you're like a son to me. You've become like a son to me. Think of yourself as my son. And he gives him a new name to mark his new status. So he marks that sort of transition with a new name. So he's adopted. He's adopted son, in a way. He's like a son. He hasn't told him he's his son. He said, you're like a son to me. So he now goes in and out of the palace. And he gets used to this fabulous environment, and he's not sort of one of the menials. But we're told he still thinks of himself as a low hireling. He still thinks of himself as a low hireling. And he gets all used to behaving properly and being with these noble and rich people and the beauty. But he goes home each night to his hovel, we're told. He goes home to his hovel. So he sort of lives on two levels. And the father says that he sees that his son, although his level of being is raised, goes home to his hovel and thinks, can't remember what it says, thinks low thoughts or something. You know, still thinks low, thinks has gross sort of bits, you know, not very good bits. So he's sort of living on two levels. He can be in the palace and then he can go home to his hovel. He does this, he sort of acts like this for 20 years, I think it is. I think it says in the sutra that he's like this for 20 years. After this time, the father can see that he's grown a lot. He's become got a lot better self-esteem. He's got used to the ways of the rich and the noble. He's got used to the ways of beautiful people. He's got used to this beautiful environment. And he says, look, I'm getting old. I want to make you my steward. I'm going to offer you a job as my steward. So as my steward, you will be my general manager. I want to take a bit of a back seat. So I want you to handle my business interests. I want you to look after my riches, my jewels, my art treasures. Look after this palace. Be my general manager. So he, from just going into the palace and getting used to it, he now handles beautiful things. He handles most precious jewels. He handles art treasures. Far from being lowly, he's in a position of command. He's quite an important person, dealing with other important people on a sort of equal level. So he moved. He's in a way he sort of comes more to really inhabit the palace. And then, as the final culmination, the father says to him, "I'm gonna have a big party, and invite all the nobles and all the royalty from miles around. And I'm gonna make a huge declaration. And at this beautiful party, you know, you can imagine this huge feast. Everything's bedecked." He says, "This is my son. This is my son. He's my heir. I'm giving everything to him." And the son says something like, "I'm amazed. I'm amazed. All this has come to me and I've done nothing to earn it." Or, "All this has come to me, you know, without me even trying." So at some level, he didn't really have to try. He felt at the end. So what is that about? What's going on there? You know, you can probably see the contrast between that and the story of the jewel in the robe. There's a few things we can say, can't we? Pretty obviously, the father is the Buddha. The father is this Buddha principle, if you like, this enlightened mind that's trying to move us up to its level. Whether we think of that as our enlightened mind, our Buddha nature in us, or some principle in acting in the universe, maybe it doesn't matter. Internal or external. Doesn't matter because we're not in touch with it. The son is not in touch with it. But that's what the father obviously is. Something trying to move the son forward. And the son? The son's us. Okay? The son is the spiritual practitioner. And this is a story about the spiritual life, isn't it? It's a description of the spiritual life. It's a description of what happens if you what the practicing the Dharma is like. What trying to grow is like. The son is us, but he's alienated from his true nature. He doesn't know that he's a rich man's son, a very rich man's son. He thinks he's poor. He's thought he was poor so long, and he's lived as poor so long, that he now is poor. It's become second nature to him. He's got all sorts of habits of being which are not congruent with being a rich man's son, going back to that model of, you know, rich is good, poor is bad. He's got loads of habits. Maybe we're like that. Maybe we've got quite a lot of habits which don't really become us. Maybe we've got used to ways of thinking, ways of feeling, ways of acting, which actually demean us. They're below us. They're beneath us. If we see ourselves from the point of view of our spiritual potential from a Buddha, we'd think, that's a bit crummy. We should go and have a wash. When we first come across our spiritual potential, when we first come across the Dharma and our spiritual potential, maybe we're scared. Do you remember the son at the gates? The son at the gates is terrified. He sees his father, but it's just something too glorious for him to relate to. So he tries to leg it out of there. And he perceives the father's attempt to help him as being something against his interests, as being, oh no, they're going to sort of stop my freedom in some way. So maybe we can't imagine ourselves as we could be. And maybe sometimes we see the spiritual life as a bit scary, as a bit dangerous, and, oh, what's it going to do to me? And maybe they're after me. Maybe they're trying to get me into their... I don't know. So maybe the Buddha has to come down to our level. So what the Buddha does is he sends men of doleful and undignified appearance. I don't know, you could probably find a few of them around the place. We were having a discussion about who they might be, whether that referred to order members, perhaps. One-eyed, squat, etc. To sort of invite us in, because that's what we're used to. You know, it offers us something we're used to. So what were we after when we first came to the Buddhist centre? You know, oh yes, I think I want to be a bit more calm. I think maybe I want to be really successful and have a Porsche, something we can relate to. Double wages, doing the sorts of things we're used to doing. Not doing anything too different, shoveling the dirt. So a reward that we can relate to. Just being a bit more sorted, something like that. The Buddha sort of comes down to our level, sort of dirts himself up and dresses down. Something we can relate to. If we knew who we really are, if we knew what we were really relating to in our moments of Shraddha, when we seem to contact something beyond us, the magnificence would perhaps terrify us. So, no, I just want to be a bit more calm. He works for a long time shoveling piles of dirt. And maybe we need to work for a long time at quite lowly stuff. Changing patterns built up over a long time is a slow process. We have to shovel the stuff from the outhouse. Maybe just knowing that we were got Buddha nature wouldn't be enough. There's sort of dirt to shovel, deep patterns that we have to shift. And maybe the Buddha starts out as being quite fierce and bossy, I only drank 5 pints of lager. Maybe that's sort of stopping us doing things we want to do, but then becomes more and more friendly. And maybe our Buddha nature, or whatever it is, whatever the Buddha represents in the Mahayana Sutras, sees us as being a bit low and inferior and feels compassion, wants to raise us to our level. The Buddha has longed for his son to stop being like that, but knew that he had work to do, basically. Responded with compassion and became more and more friendly, transformed from a boss to a sort of friend, to a foster father, to a father. So maybe the Dharma, the Buddha, our Buddha nature, whatever, gradually introduces us to the riches and the treasures and the beauty that we're heir to, but only very, very gradually. Gradually refines us, gradually teaches us, gradually raises our level of being, gradually raises our self-esteem. And maybe for a while we live on two levels. I think this is quite a common experience. Maybe for a while we live on two levels. We can have meditations, periods when we seem to be in a palace. You know, our being is wonderful. It's lovely. We're in touch with states that are great. We're in a palace. We're in a wonderful garden. We're in a pure land. We can have that, but we go back sometimes, every night, whenever, to our hovel, our usual mental states, our sort of rather dim and dirty sort of mental states, where we experience lowly thoughts. But then maybe over time, the palace becomes second nature to us, and we're offered the kingdom. We're offered the palace and all the jewels and the paradisical gardens and everything else. So that's the story, and that's my, if you like, interpretation of it. And I think you can see, looking at, there's two stories. There are two stories about Buddha nature in the Lotus Sutra. There's more than two, but there's two, at least two. One is the story of the jewel in the robe. Ah, I've got the jewel. That's it. Yippee. And the other, the rich man's son who needs to work for years shoveling out dirt from outhouses, gradually get used to going into the palace, etc., etc. Takes him decades of work before he's actually raised to the point where he can be who he is or who he should be. You can see that there's two really different takes on Buddha nature there, quite different takes on Buddha nature. And you might have come across this idea of Buddha nature or, you know, all sorts of phrases like that if you've read books on, for example, Zen or some other traditions. It's used quite a lot, and it can get taken wrongly. So it can be a really inspiring idea. Can be a really inspiring idea which somehow fits with our feeling about the spiritual life. That, yeah, there's something in me wants me to move forward. There's something in me that's urging me to move forward, move on. And I seem to contact it maybe in meditation. And it's what's sort of inviting me. And those really great moments of Shraddha are sort of like my future self, the self I could be, sort of saying, come on, it's this way. We can get that feeling that we've got this real sort of strong inner guide. And as Sangharakshita has said, in a way, if we didn't have that, if we didn't have Buddha nature, if it wasn't deep in us, we wouldn't respond to the path in the first place. It's the fact that we've got that that makes us respond. It talks to something deep in us which says, yes, I want that. So it's a very, very inspiring idea. But it sometimes gets taken quite wrong, because it sometimes gets interpreted as being, well, actually, because we've got Buddha nature, that's it. All we need to do is realize it and relax into it, let go into it, experience it. That's the sort of jewel in the robe. That seems to be the jewel in the robe sort of approach. It's not my experience, and I don't think it's many people's experience. It seems to be much more common experience that we might know that, we might be told that, but we've got a lot of work to do. There are piles of crap to be moved. There's old, lowly hovels of the mind to leave behind. There's a gradual process that's got to go through, that's going to take a while. It's not just going to happen like that. And that seems to be much more realistic. That seems to be a much more realistic approach. We need to do more than just remember we've got the jewel. We need to do more than just know we've got Buddha nature. We've got a lot of work to do to actually manifest it, to actually make it the reality, make it what we live out of. So, yeah, going back to the Buddha nature idea, we can use that as a sort of creative myth. It really works. It really speaks to us. It answers a lot of our, you know, for a lot of us, it seems to match our experience. But what we mustn't do is think that means that we don't need to work hard at the spiritual life. If we think that it means that I can just somehow let go effortlessly into it, then we're going to get very, very lost, basically. It's not going to work. So we just need to sort of take it with that proviso. We need to take it with that proviso. There's a really good, if very difficult, Buddhist text called The Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana, where it talks about this stuff. And it's, but it says, anyone who thinks that, you know, it says we're like a vein of rock. We're like a vein of rock that's got jewels and it's got gold in it. We're like a vein of rock that's got gold in it. But anyone thinks that you can get that gold out without pounding it and heating it and refining it and getting rid of the dross is just deluding themselves. So yeah, Buddha nature is a fine idea, but we mustn't fall into what's sometimes been caricatured as sort of California Zen idea that, well, hey man, you know, I mean, I'm a Buddha already. I don't need to do anything. I just manifest my Buddha nature. And, you know, that's my practice. Spending loads of money is my practice. I don't need to make any effort about the spiritual life. I don't need to make effort in meditation. I just relax into something. Well, sometimes we can just relax into something, but usually because we've done an awful lot of shoveling dirt first, basically. I notice that sometimes people say it's effortless. It's effortless. Well, yeah, it is, isn't it? The last minute. If you remember the guy, the son in the parable of the rich man and his son, at the end said, who would have thought that I would inherit all this? And I didn't make any effort for it. I didn't try and get it at all. So sometimes people maybe at the end of the path say, well, I didn't try at all. I didn't have to make any effort. No, he'd only shoveled all that dirt and all the rest of it. That's why it seemed effortless. It seemed effortless because he'd made loads of effort in the past and then it came to him. So we need to just bear that in mind when we start thinking about Buddha nature, when we start using that word, that it's not like it's just there. It's not like there are nice bars of gold in the rock. It's in the form of stuff that needs a lot of work to get it out, to manifest it. There's a guy called Subhuti who sort of pointed out that there are sort of three models of the spiritual life. If we're here and Buddhahood is there, there's three ways that we can move. One is what he called self-development. We see it as I work on myself to develop. One is what he called self-unfoldment, which is I discover it in myself and allow it to unfold. And the third is self-surrender, that I surrender to something higher than myself and it moves me forward. And he pointed out that we maybe need a bit of all of those. But we need to start with self-development. You know, at the end he may have felt, oh, I've just come into my, the son might have felt, I just came into my true nature. And I was helped all, he was helped all along by his father. But he had to do a lot of work. And if we don't do that work, if the son had said, well, I'm not shifting any piles of dirt, I'm off. No story, right? So I suppose the moral is it's very much the Buddhist pattern and it's very much the FWBO pattern. That we've got to start with working. We've got to start with sometimes doing things that don't seem like second nature because our second nature has become other. Sometimes instead of reaching for the beer, we meditate. Reaching for the TV remote, we meditate. We make effort. We go on retreat when it seems like, why should I go on retreat? I have to get up early. We do all sorts of things that actually feel like effort because that's the way that the Buddha nature manifests. Okay, of those three models, great, yeah, we need a bit of all of them. Great to think of Buddha nature. Great also to have a sense of surrendering to something bigger than ourselves, the cosmic Buddha of the Lotus Sutra, if you like. But also, none of it matters if we're not making the effort ourselves.